This is All Things Education, a podcast where three-decade teachers discuss what they know.
The good, the not-so-good, and the continuous opportunity for high-quality education in Texas.
Join us for a smart conversation as we dig deep into the issues that affect us all in and around our great state.
And here are those three scrupulous instructors now. Hey everybody, welcome back to All Things Education. My name, as always, is Lance Barish, and I teach high school math, everybody's favorite, up here in the great metroplex of Dallas-Fort Worth.
Hey everyone, Matthew Walter here. I am an electives teacher in good old Austin ISD.
Good morning, you guys. My name is Natalie Adias, and I am an art teacher here in San Antonio.
Great to see you, as always. So, what are we going to talk about today? Well, we are all wrapping up our first semester of the 25-26 school year, and so in these times, like many other Americans, I find myself reflecting quite a bit. And specifically in education, I like to reflect on all that my students have accomplished so far this year. We're not at the finish line yet, that's May, but we're at the halfway point, give or take. So I like to think about what they've learned, right? Learning is the whole goal of our project, right? We do obviously have to look at final exams at the high school level, and that sucks up a lot of the oxygen in December or sometimes in January for a lot of our listeners and a lot of our students. And tests, you know, they dominate a lot of the conversation. But I think the three of us know that the real learning is happening each and every day, not just on that, you know, testing day at the end of the semester. What's that cliche? It's the journey, not the destination after all. So I was wondering if the two of you have any noteworthy anecdotes or share outs of maybe like a recent lesson or a class that you taught, perhaps that mythical aha moment that, you know, hooks us always and still catches our breath after all these years of teaching. Matthew, let's start with you.
For me, there have been a lot of aha moments this year. It's been really, really awesome because I've gotten the opportunity to teach an entirely new class, one that I've created from scratch, and that is video game design. It's a semester-long elective. For the past 4 years, I've been running an after-school video game program and have been managing a few esports teams on my campus. And I floated the idea to my principal last year at the end of starting an electives course on video game design. And I was lucky enough to get that opportunity. And now I am, running with it. It's been awesome. It's been challenging, but it's been a lot of fun. And for me, the aha moment, one of many, would just be that there's so many ways to teach writing skills and literacy skills and embed them into a course that you wouldn't even anticipate connects with that. We are writing full-on stories in my video game class, and their writing skills as a result of that have really developed even within the semester. So that's been really cool.
Very nice. My content comes with a lot of opportunity for aha moments, sometimes in the curriculum itself and the discussion around art and artists and movements and things like that. It's always nice when kids make connections to the real world. I've always said that I'm a major promoter of literacy, but I don't think that that just means reading words on a page. I think it means reading the world around us. And so that's something that I try to encourage and a skill that I try to develop in my students every year through my content. But sometimes it's also in the actual tangible skill and the application. When kids have a light bulb moment themselves, whether that's recognizing something in the subject matter that we're working with or the media that we're working with, more often it's when they doubt their own ability to successfully apply those new skills and techniques that they're learning. And then when they do, and they are like beaming with pride because it's the best thing they've ever created, I really think that they carry that into the rest of their day. I hope that they carry that confidence into the rest of their schedule and that trickles over in an ideal world. What they get out of my class trickles over into their confidence in accessing other core content, like what you teach, Lance.
Oh, what a transition to me. And I mean, both of your share outs there were just so inspirational. And that curriculum you're designing, Matthew, just sounds sensational and so cool, right? And ironically, my share out here actually kind of touches on final exams because we do have to take some here in my high school Algebra 2 class. And my thing that drove me over the last month is a little bit more narrow than designing an entire new curriculum, but I kind of overhauled my final exam review process this year. I thought this was the year to not run those same worksheets, you know, from, I don't know, 2012. And so I rewrote them. I made them a little bit more targeted with some application problems and rolled those out. And I think they've been really successful. And that just like invigorated me. And I know our listeners are thinking, final exam review can invigorate a teacher? Yeah, you bet it can. It was a really fun week in my class when a lot of times some of that review process can be rote or boring or tedious. So hopefully my students echo that. And in fact, just last week on Thursday, one of the Algebra 2 topics we were reviewing was everybody's favorite. We were talking about logarithms. In fact, really quick, Natalie, Matthew, can you really tell our listeners what is a logarithm and what it's used for?
I was just going to say, what is a logarithm? I have no recollection of it.
I don't really do numbers.
Like when I was in, what, 9th, 10th grade or something? Yeah. No memory.
Natalie, you remember them?
I can guarantee you I do not remember what a logarithm is, but I am so excited for you to tell us again.
Yes. Are you really?
I am just on the edge of my seat.
Well, I mean, first of all, it's not an algorithm, which is a word that has definitely permeated our, you know, vernacular, you know, through social media and all of those things. It is a very technical operation in the math class that helps us when we're solving for unknown exponents, right? Or maybe trying to solve an exponential equation that has some irrational numbers involved, right? Yes? Good memories?
Wait, logarithm just refers to like the process of working through the formula?
So the word formula is very charged in the algebra classroom, right? We do need
them. Oh, now we're getting
sometimes
into the juicy stuff.
Yeah. But yeah, you're not too far off the mark. But maybe our listeners and you both as avatars for our listeners are wondering why we even still learn about logarithms. When are we ever going to use that knowledge in our real life, right? Have you ever asked that question before to a teacher?
Definitely.
Yeah, for sure. I think we all have.
Yeah. In fact, if I had a nickel for every time a student asked me, when are we going to use this in the real world? Well, I think you know the end of that sentence. It's actually the bane of all math teachers, especially in algebra, my beloved field. And honestly, I think the question is missing the point. Nothing against a student that would ask that question because it's a really valid concern. But the study of math gets such a bad rap for having all these intricacies and seemingly no, you know, quote unquote, direct applications to real life. In fact, sometimes when I talk to newer teachers in my field, I feel like many are chasing that kind of idea that if they designed a perfect scenario where someday if I teach this geometry lesson perfect, then flash forward 10 years and they'll remember how to find the area of a composite polygon because they're carpeting their floors, right? Or whatever. It doesn't really work like that. We don't remember our 9th grade geometry class unless we just had the best teacher of all time. And so sometimes it's not the best move to just shoehorn in, you know, Fortnite or 6-7 or whatever the new meme is. And I know I sound like a grandpa right now, into a word problem that really is just about solving a quadratic function or something like that, artificial. And it just doesn't work that way.
Yeah. Wow. Tell us how you really think, math boy.
Math boy. I'm surrounded by humanity.
You're touching on a good point, though. You're touching on a good point.
You sound a little curmudgeonly, but you are touching on a very valid point that it's, you know, it's, there's not always such a direct correlation.
Yeah. And we, in our training, we often are, we talk a lot in our field about buy-in and making the learning relevant to students. And there are opportunities to do that that make sense. But I agree with you. I think it's valid to encourage the love of learning. to continue. It seems like that is inherent in students in elementary school, and then something happens when they hit middle school. All of a sudden, it's like, they need to know their return on investment.
Yeah, that's a really good way to phrase it. And the bottom line is that I hope that my love of math is bleeding through more than anything else, more than any other relevant application, because frankly, I love it and I love teaching it. I've been loving teaching it for a decade and a half. And you know what? I'm going to use this, resolution time of the year to declare here at the end of 2025, I refuse to field that question anymore. When am I going to use this in the real world?
You're no longer going to dignify it with an answer.
I'm not going to. It is so far outside the scope of my technical subject when I teach algebra or calculus, and it's missing the point. So I want to kind of give y'all a little bit of the floor here as well. We have humanities and electives in the room. Tell me, I think our listeners maybe are still interested in why we love and why we teach what we teach. And so I wanted to give you the opportunity to speak on it. And Natalie, let's start with you on this one.
So when I came into education, I did that through alternative certification. And when you went through the alternative route back then, they kind of shuffled you, or what's the word I'm looking for? Funneled you through like content areas based on what you would be highly qualified to teach based on your background. And so for me, my degree was in English, is in English. And so I started teaching high school English, which I really enjoyed in terms of exploring big ideas. That was something that I was really interested in doing with my kids to make it interesting and to make it relevant. I was able to translate, old poetry and prose and literature into modern day relevance for my students so they could understand like the core of what was going on in terms of comprehension. And in hopes that that would develop some new ideas. And then when I had the opportunity to do that in a different content area, I took advantage of that opportunity. I only taught high school English for 3 years, and that was enough for me to decide that I was not thrilled with the limitations on what I was able to teach based on the state standards, based on the state assessments. So fortunately, in art, I found a space where I am still able to explore those big ideas with students just in a different way. And I'm grateful to have that opportunity. I know that core content classes and some other state mandated courses are definitely under a closer microscope, if you will, in terms of what we teach and how we teach it. So that's how I got into my content area. What about you, Matt?
Yeah, well, we actually have a pretty similar story there. I've had a long and perilous journey to get to where I'm at now, but I started off more or less teaching U.S. history. I love U.S. history. Growing up, I was a big, big history buff, studied poli-sci and history in college, and really, I thought that this was going to be the subject for me. And I taught it at the eighth grade level. For a number of years, I really did enjoy it. But like you, Natalie, I was getting increasingly more and more frustrated with the limitations of the subject. U.S. history this is the first time students are tested with the STAR test in history. And there's just a lot of material that you have to cover. I was teaching at Title I schools, and it started to really feel like I was just teaching to the test. Anyway, I switched schools, and I started off teaching creative writing. This was a new course for our school. I am deeply passionate about writing and creative writing. I have an MFA. In creative writing. For as long as I can remember, I've been fascinated by stories and deeply passionate about storytelling. And so I was able to start a creative writing class from scratch at my school. I had complete autonomy and freedom to do it the way that I wanted to do it. it was pretty successful. I started the next year, I started an advanced creative writing class that's been an absolute blast. I love it so much. Love the kids in that class so much. And then, as I said, this year I've started a video game design class. And like I said before, I've been running this video game program at my school for a number of years now. The sort of like core principle or mission behind it is to teach students social emotional learning skills through video games, collaboration, teamwork. And yeah, it's been a blast. But I think what I really love about what I do is that I have complete trust from the administration, and that, you know, they believe I know what I'm doing, and I am creating it all.
Yeah.
So yeah, well, it's total freedom.
Great stuff from both of you. And your passion just comes straight through the microphone on what you teach. And I hope mine does as well for math. I love it. I grew up loving math. My mom was a math professor at the college level, and I just think it rocks. And I like that word that you use there, Matthew, at the end, trust, because I feel a lot of trust in my school as well and in my district to teach what's right, you know. But I thought maybe we could go a little bit deeper for our listeners on what we teach and how we know what it is that we're supposed to teach, quote unquote. In fact, if you read some headlines, a lot of time parents are expressing concern about their grade school age kids and what they're learning in the classroom. And I think that's very valid. I think as a parent myself, I'm always curious about what my student is hearing and what they're learning in their classroom in any subject. So those questions are really valid. And I don't necessarily mean to make any of this controversial or provocative, but how does a new teacher know what to teach? And how can we ensure that they're teaching that thing? Let's get really specific on this. For example, I teach pre-calculus, and I'm governed by a document of standards called the TEKS, T-E-K-S, or maybe TEKS. I've heard it pronounced a lot of different ways. That's just an acronym that stands for the Texas Essential Knowledge and Skills. It is a actual genuine list, bullet-pointed list of you must teach this, you must teach this, you must teach this. Logarithms are on there, which I know everybody's excited about, along Woo-hoo! With... you know, various other fun things like vectors and trigonometry and all the fun stuff, right? But the TEKS doesn't just come out of the ether, right, or out of the earth. It was not handed down to us from Mount Sinai. It comes from the Texas Education Agency, which is an implementation wing of a governing body called the State Board of Education. And that's how I know what I'm supposed to teach so that I can award my students a pre-calculus credit. Now, I know that all sounded maybe a little bit didactic or technical, but let's make it fun for the listeners. How do you know what you're supposed to teach, Matthew? And how do you, you know, does anybody ever check on you?
Oh, I'm a really, really bad example of this, Lance.
Don't get yourself in trouble.
Yeah, so I'm playing under the radar here. But like I said, Okay, I don't teach to the TEKS.
I said, don't get controversial, Matthew.
Yeah,
oh, there it is.
Yeah, we created these classes from scratch.
There you go.
And I being held accountable? No, not at all. Is anybody checking on me? No, not at all. Am I being reviewed? Sure, but it's pretty meaningless. Somebody comes in my room once a year with notification telling me that they're coming into my room, and we meet beforehand and they see me teach a lesson, and then they give me good grades and let me go. That's why I love what I teach, though.
I'm
a really, really, really bad example of this.
Let me just interject that you've earned that through a long career of expertise. What about like a new teacher that you'd be mentoring, right?
Yeah. And for a long, long time. So I've been teaching for 15 years, I think. Oh my God. For a long, long time, I went through the rigmarole. And when I was a new teacher, you know, one of the first things that happens is you're handed the TEKS. You sit down, with a mentor or some kind of campus leader, maybe an AP, and together you walk through all of the TEKS. This is the blueprint of what you are by law supposed to teach in your classroom. And usually if you're a new teacher, hopefully you have some kind of mentor that you're working with throughout the year, and you talk with that mentor about how you are going to teach specific TEKS. You talk through your timeline. Oftentimes, the district kind of determines the timeline or the time frame for when you are supposed to get through X TEK or whatever. And so you draw out your scope and sequence, and then you talk about sort of like, you know, your unit. And then you talk about sort of like your weekly lesson plans. And then you talk about sort of like what skills within each lesson you're going to try to get through and how.
Yeah, my experience is very similar. I think because we're both in an elective course, there's just a lot more flexibility. The TEKS themselves for art classes in Texas are pretty broad, pretty vague, and they vary from one level to another, like a middle school art one compared to a studio art for high school credit class that I teach at the middle school. You know, the capabilities that they want students to have when they leave the course, when they complete the course, are different in expectation, as they should be. I mean, that just makes sense that a sixth grader would be doing something different. We would have a different expectation of them their very first year in the middle school art class compared to the eighth grader who's has an advanced level of skill and has been taking art for 2 years before they enter that last eighth grade year of middle school. So, but in terms of what to teach, I mean, it is a very vague blueprint. That was a good word, Matt, for art in particular, as opposed to some of the core content TEKS that are very specific in terms of your student needs to know what a logarithm is and how to
do
it.
Yes, they do. Preach.
Right? In my case, it's like they need to be able to create original artwork based on lived experience, observations, community, culture, et cetera. That's so broad and vague that I have a lot of room to kind of move about the cabin there in terms of how I accomplish that. So I think for Matt and I, that regulatory piece in terms of the content standards is definitely more flexible than yours, Lance, and other core classes. But I do utilize that along with the scope and sequence that's provided by my district in terms of, you know, art is sequential. You start with drawing and then you build in color theory and move into painting and then you move into from 2D to 3D. So there is kind of an intentional sequence to it that just makes sense cognitively. But also we're kind of the default flexible people who have to make everything else work on campus. So if I had plans to start a ceramic unit, but they need to use my room for testing for some reason, then I'm going to have to adapt and adjust. And I'm not necessarily married to the scope and sequence in that sense.
Sounds like you know how to adapt, though, which is awesome. I have less flexibility as a core content teacher, as you intimated there, Natalie. And it's interesting too that in all of our shareouts here, it's very cut and dry, right? It's like technical. We're applying our pedagogical expertise when we make these decisions, and yet sometimes it actually does get controversial. And so I thought maybe for our final segment today, we could examine that just a little bit. For example, we didn't always have the TEKS. The TEKS started around the early 1990s, right? Which predates all of our careers, but not our lives. So it's a relatively recent thing, this specific thing. It replaced a previous standard system called the Essential Elements or something like that. I might be misquoting that. And then over the years, just depending on the people that are in charge, it actually does get politicized. About 10 or 15 years ago, there was a movement towards a national standard, which in Texas you'll never hear about in a classroom, and that was called the Common Core. We didn't adopt it. Not only did we not adopt it, it's actually on the books. It's a state law that we cannot teach the Common Core from a 2013 legislative session here in Texas. So you won't see any of those standards. So we do it our way, right, here in Texas. And the obvious question maybe that comes out of all this is that if I'm a new teacher, and like Matthew, when you described you got that list of that teaks, we got to ask that question, right? Who are these creators of these standards? Who are these arbiters of that is what actually should be in the standards? And what happens when and if that gets political? I'm a little bit troubled from a recent report that I read in November. Texas Tribune reported on this, and we'll put the link in our show notes, about a potential overhaul to the state's social studies curriculum, especially in K-8, where the State Board of Education, which is an elected body of 15 members, have hired a panel of consultants to overhaul the curriculum in social studies with a heavy emphasis on Texas history, America's role in geopolitical events, and maybe what some are describing as conservative values seeping into the classroom. So what happens when things get political in the classroom, and how does that affect y'all in what you're teaching?
I mean, yeah, there's a ton there. So I think it's important for our listeners to point out that who creates these teaks, right? So this really comes down to, in Texas, the State Board of Education, or SBOE, they decide which subjects to revise and when. And SBOC is made up of about 15, it's made up of 15 members. This is a political board. And I believe they update subjects every 8 to 12 years. And there's a long process of review and drafts that go into making revisions to subjects. But it can become very politicized when special interest groups get involved, which happens. This can be anything from private businesses to parent associations to religious groups, lobbyists, political think tanks, and so forth. So the process is convoluted and complicated, but it is very, very politicized. And Lance, you're absolutely right in pointing out that the most recent changes ahead are with social studies. Everything that I've seen is really, really concerning, I guess is the best way to put it. For me personally, I guess that was your question. For me personally, how does this affect me? Well, the subject that I teach isn't affected. So my classes will more or less be the same. I will say this, though. We have an eighth grade teacher who is retiring this year. She is a U.S. history teacher. U.S. history is a STAR-tested subject. Being a STAR-tested subject in AISD, Austin Independent School District, means that if you teach that class, you have the opportunity to receive TIA money. If you, simply put, if your kids score well enough on the STAR test, you can get a good chunk of change from the state. $10,000-$12,000 that would go to your paycheck for the next, 3-5 years or whatever. This position is up at my school. I could apply for this position. I think I'd have a pretty good chance of getting it. I would have a pretty good chance of making $12,000 a year more in what I teach. That $12,000 a year more would go toward my pension, my retirement. On a teacher's salary, just being honest here and transparent, that makes a big difference. That's my life. That's my well-being.
But what comes
sorry, Natalie, go ahead.
No, I said, but what comes with the agreement that you make to get that extra money?
My freedom. And the idea that rather than teaching something I love, which is U.S. history, I would now have to teach something mandated by a politically controversial decision from the state. I guess sell my soul for $10,000 a year. I don't know.
Right. Depends on, I guess it depends on your bills, right?
Yeah, it's a lot of money, but like even just the fact that that's a question I'm having right now, because I don't want to teach kids history this way. I don't want to teach them Texas history for the fourth time, for the fourth year in the row that they've had Texas history. That's going to be really boring for the kids.
Yeah, and right? It's not just the teaks that are affected. I mean, yeah. It starts with the teaks, but then that kind of trickles down into the resources that we use to teach. And so we've talked in the past about how high quality instructional materials and instructional material review boards and panels and things that the state puts together. This is like the next tier of that, is that they start adapting and adjusting and sometimes altogether removing text that has been used that might have valuable information. It's one thing to keep resources up to date, but it's another thing to alter them. And I think one of the things that's concerning to me is when we see how those materials are altered. For example, when they rolled out high quality instructional materials, HQIM as an initiative, we talked a lot about how the positive points of that and how it could be beneficial to teachers in terms of gifting them time and making the what to teach a little bit more clear and less cloudy. And in all of those ways, yes, that sounds like a great deal. But then we come to find out that some of those resources are leaning one way or another, and very obviously so, in how the content is presented. For example, this Blue Bonnet curriculum that the state is incentivizing districts to adopt with money, because it always comes with that. But that Blue Bonnet curriculum is very heavily based in Christian teachings. And then you get into this hairy sort of separation between church and state situation.
And let me just add to that, Natalie, just to kind of bring it back to the social studies thing, and then please continue, that in those panel of nine advisors that the state board hired, one does include a documented far-right conservative Christian who has beliefs that were debunked by historians that America was founded as a Christian nation, which it just wasn't. And that kind of will go hand in hand with something like that Blue Bonnet curriculum.
Right. And I've heard also recently when they were reviewing some of our science materials in the secondary level, you know, there are people like you were talking about, Matt, who are influencing the decision making. For example, an entire science text was removed from approved materials statewide because somebody in the oil industry did not like the way that fossil fuels, if you will, were presented. And so all of that is not the first thing that I think anybody thinks about, especially when you're new to the field, because you're coming in and you're just thinking like, okay, I've got to figure out my role in all of this. But as is with the three of us, the longer you're in it and the more you recognize what's happening, the more directly you feel the impact of that in your practice. And at the end of the day, I think it's valuable to have different backgrounds and mindsets on any kind of panel or board that makes a decision. But I think the intent needs to be that it is collectively unbiased in the content that we're producing to students. And so when you talk about what happens when and if that gets political, that's kind of the risk that we face. That's the risk that is presented when so much of it becomes bureaucratic or political.
And I just want to point out something that you said earlier, Lance. It wasn't always this way, right? We didn't have the teaks, you know, until the 1990s. The state has, over the past couple of decades, just gained so much more control and power over what we teach, and that has had a lot of detrimental effects to public education nationwide and certainly in the state of Texas. But, you know, before the 1980s, before the 1990s even, a lot of the decisions in terms of what we teach, how we teach them, what we use for resources and materials was left up to the local districts and schools. And I think that the pendulum has just swung too far in the other direction.
Yeah, and coinciding with the amount of control being exerted over this what we teach is a long period in Texas where basically one side and one viewpoint has been in charge of everything at the government level. So food for thought, obviously all viewpoints are valid there, but if we go 30 plus years and only one side is getting a say in what's going on, that should maybe have you scratching your head either way. And I want to kind of land the plane here by just going right back to that headline, that Texas Tribune headline, because in that board decision to hire these nine consultants or advisors on this social studies curriculum overhaul, besides the fact that nine people is such a small number, and they're all chosen by this other very small group of 15 people, the state board, in that group of nine, there is only one person that currently works in a school district. And that person is not a teacher. And as a teacher, from my own very narrow pulpit, as the person that is in front of the kids with a direct vested interest in the outcomes of those kids and their futures, especially in what you were describing, Matthew, with that anecdote about TIA, I just want to say that I hope that our listeners are encouraged by us talking that they can trust us to devise the best and most exciting math lessons that I know how to impart with my love of teaching this great content to the kids that come through my doors year in and year out. I am not on an advisory committee or a school board or a state board of education, but I know what I'm supposed to do and I know how to teach it well. And I think the results speak for themselves over the years, not to brag, right? So we usually like to end these episodes with an ask or maybe a takeaway for our listeners. So I'm going to keep it really simple today. I highly encourage you to just trust your kids' teachers to be the experts in their fields, not just in the content, but in the pedagogy. It is literally what we trained for. And if you want to take it a step further this holiday season, although maybe you're listening to this after the holidays, I know no teacher that would say no to yet another Starbucks gift card.
And you know what? It doesn't even need to be blind trust. I'm just going to tack on to that we always encourage parent investment and communication. And I think I am always ready, willing, and able to have a conversation with a parent about what we're going to be doing in my class. And I think that that's another thing to encourage is if there isn't ever a question or a concern, go directly to that expert, instructional expert that your child is fortunate enough to have day in and day out and make that a collaborative conversation.
Well said. So happy holidays, everybody. Happy New Year. And feel free to reach out to us directly through Instagram at All Things Education Podcast for more information on how to join or start conversations about public education in your community. Matthew and Natalie, as always, it has been a great pleasure, and we'll talk to you soon.
Bye, y'all.
Holidays.
Thank you for listening to All Things Education.
Be sure to leave us a review and share the show with everyone you know.
And if you liked what you heard, stay tuned for more compelling conversations with Natalie, Matthew, and Lance.
Until next time, Texas.